Perth, significantly milder than Friday, with Saturday afternoon highs of around 12 degrees Celsius. And the outlook for Sunday, high pressure will maintain pleasant and mild spring-like conditions across the southern half of England and Wales, but always cloudier across the northern half of the UK, with some light and patchy rain in places. Did it sound like I knew what I was talking about? Right, now on Radio 4, Peter Firth reads a final essay from James Wood's collection, The Fun Stuff. Tonight he packs up his father-in-law's library and considers what book collections have to say about their owners.
My father-in-law died last year, and my mother-in-law is ailing. So this summer, we drove up to my parents-in-law's house to empty it for sale. I knew that what awaited us in Canada was the puzzle of how to dispose of my father-in-law's library, a collection of about 4,000 books, asleep in a large Victorian house in the flat, open fields of rural Ontario. We would take perhaps 100 back to Boston, but had no room in our house for more. And then what? François-Michel Messud, my father-in-law, was a complicated, difficult, brilliant man. He was born in France, but spent his early childhood in Algiers, and then, nomadically, in Beirut, Istanbul, and Salonika. In the early 1950s, he came to America as one of the first Fulbright scholars, and stayed on to do graduate work in Middle Eastern studies. He started a PhD on Turkish politics, but abandoned it and went into business, a decision probably born of academic anxiety and patriarchal masochism. He was, in fact, not a very engaged businessman and retained the instincts of a fine scholar and curious traveller. His mind was worldly, with little hospitality towards literature or music or philosophy. What interested him were societies, tribes, roots, exile, journeys, languages. I found him easier to admire than to love, and rather feared him. Educated in an austere French environment, a child of the deprivations of the 1930s and 1940s, he could be captious, censorious, bullying. After 6 in the evening, when cocktails made everything hazardous, one learned to tread carefully, for fear of splashing into an error that might be roughly corrected. Not to know precisely who the Phoenicians were, not to know the names of the two most famous mosques in Istanbul, or the history of the civil war in Lebanon, or the ethnic composition of the Albanians. Not to recall exactly who said, "Beware of Greeks bearing gifts," or to fluff a French phrase, or to praise something by Bruce Chatwin, was to court swift disdain. I was grateful not to be his son. His anxious male authority was so different from my reticent father's that I was alternately impressed and alienated by it. Once, early in my marriage, when I had been living in France for a few months and my ability with the language was improving, we were at dinner and someone praised me for my increased fluency. Everyone else piously agreed.
"I don't see why I should praise you yet," my father-in-law broke in. "It's a very small improvement and you have a long way to go."
I knew he would say it, hated him for it, and agreed with him. He himself liked to recount the story of arriving from France at Amherst College in 1954 and being told by his American roommate that he would never really master English.
"I could speak it fluently by Christmas," he would say. Whether the story was true or not, he spoke perfect English without a French accent, except for a tendency to pronounce tongue as tong and swan as if he were saying swam. He had the foreigner's Nabokovian love of exhuming dead puns, was tirelessly amused, for instance, by the fact that the Archbishop of Canterbury is officially known as Primate of All England and therefore should be called Chief Chimp. Tribes and societies interested him because he grew up in a tribe, left it for a society, and belonged to neither. His tribe was French Algerian, the Pieds Noirs, the European colonists who went to Algeria in the early 19th century and abandoned it en masse at the end of the War for Independence in 1962. He never returned after independence to the country of his childhood, so that Algeria and indeed a whole world of Francophone North African experience could only be experienced in the mind. France, the larger home,
was an ambiguous pleasure, as for many of the returning colonists. Though his sister settled in Toulon, he never showed much interest in the country, and as a result was refreshingly free of the usual maddening French superiority. Instead, he came to America, where he lived most of his adult life, but he was not an especially eager immigrant nor a willing Democrat. Once the early excitements of the Fulbright and the graduate school waned, he settled into a familiar European alienation. He floated on top of American life, privileged, wounded, unmoored. I think that the most important book in his study was a huge atlas. Wide open on a wooden lectern, the pages turned daily. Sometimes we would catch him standing at the lectern, peering down at the dense, abstract grids of some newfound interest. He travelled widely and systematically, each trip to Egypt, Greece, Indonesia, Peru, Morocco, Burma, India, Russia, thoroughly planned out, prepared for with advanced reading and orderly itineraries, and then preserved, usually by his wife, in photographs of buildings and cities, pyramids, temples, mosques, streets, columns, ruins. And he read in the same way. He followed interests like an army moving along a line of supply and searched out all the available books on a particular subject. He acquired far more books than he could read. The acquisition of a book signalled not just the potential acquisition of knowledge, but something like the property rights to a piece of ground. The knowledge became a visitable place. His immediate surroundings, his American or Canadian surroundings, were of no great interest to him. I never heard him speak with any excitement about Manhattan, for instance. But the Alhambra in 1492, or the Salonica he remembered from childhood, or the Constantinople of the late Byzantine Empire were... what? If I say they were alive for him, the usual cliché, then I make him sound more scholarly and perhaps more imaginative than he actually was. It would be closer to the truth to say that such places were facts for him, in a way that Manhattan and Toronto and even Paris were not. And yet these facts were largely incommunicable. He spent his time among businessmen, not scholars. He rarely invited people to dinner, and he could become emphatic and monologic, flourishing his facts as querulous challenges rather than as invitations to conversation, though this wasn't perhaps his real intention. So there always seemed to be a quality of self-defense about the greedy rate at which he acquired books, as if he were putting on layers of clothing to protect against the drafts of exile. Libraries are always paradoxical. They are as personal as the collector, and at the same time represent an ideal statement of knowledge that is impersonal, because it is universal, abstract, and so much larger in sum than an individual life. Susan Sontag once said to me that her essays were more intelligent than she was because she worked so hard at them and expanded into them over several months of writing. I murmured something banal about how the critic conducts his education in public, and she bristled. Gesturing towards her huge library, she said with certainty, "That isn't what I meant. I've read all these books." I didn't believe her, since no one has read one's entire library, and it seemed strange of her not to comprehend what I intended to say, which was simply that, like her essays, her library was also more intelligent than she was. This was acutely true of my father-in-law's library, which was not a working library like hers, but an underemployed collection for a working mind. My father-in-law's will to completion, his need to encompass a subject by buying all the available books and reading them and then putting them out, represented an ideal, a kind of abstract utopia, a long shelf of careful, brilliant books, all devoted to one subject, was the best possible life that subject could enjoy. He had 300 or 400 books on aspects of the Byzantine Empire and probably twice that number on Islamic and Middle Eastern subjects. I spent the first few days in Canada cataloguing the Middle Eastern books in the hope that we might be able to keep the collection intact and perhaps give them to an institution, a college, a local library, even a mosque. It was slow, intricate, engrossing work. 58 books on Egypt alone. From Alfred Butler's The Arab Conquest of Egypt, first published in 1902, to Florence Nightingale's Letters from Her Journey on the Nile, to Taha Hussein's memoir, An Egyptian Childhood, originally published in Cairo in 1932. But it soon became apparent that no one really wants hundreds or thousands of old books. Emails sent to librarians were unanswered. Someone told us about a public library in a town in Alberta that had burned to the ground. They were going to rebuild and needed donations. I was ready to ship hundreds, but the website requested only books published in the last 2 years, which excluded almost everything in my father-in-law's library. We had a couple of breaks. An online bookseller, who deals in rare books and first editions, came and picked through what interested him and filled his old station wagon with boxes. A few days later, an English bibliophile who teaches philosophy at Queen's did the same. I enjoyed their obvious excitement, my enjoyment tempered by the sensation that the library was suffering death by a thousand cuts. For in any private library, the totality of books is meaningful, while each individual volume is relatively meaningless. Or rather, once separated from its family, each becomes relatively meaningless in relation to the original collector, but suddenly newly meaningful as the totality of the author's mind. The lovely book Mecca, A Literary History of the Muslim Holy Land, by the great New York University scholar F. E. Peters, says little about my father-in-law, except that he bought it. But it represents a distillation of Professor Peters' life work. In this strange way, our libraries are like certain paintings that, as you get closer to the canvas, become separate and unreadable blobs and daubs of paint. And in this way, I began to think our libraries perhaps say nothing very particular about us at all. Each brick in the wall of a library is a borrowed brick, not one made by the bricklayer. Several thousand people, perhaps several hundred thousand, own books by F. E. Peters. We tend to venerate libraries once we know whose they are, like admiring a famous philosopher's eyes or a ballet dancer's foot. Pushkin had about 1,000 non-Russian books in his library, and the editor of Pushkin on Literature helpfully lists them, from Balzac and Stendhal to Shakespeare and Voltaire. She confidently announces, "Much can be learnt of a man from his choice of books," and then unwittingly contradicts herself by adding that Pushkin, like many Russians of his class, read mostly in French. The ancient classics, the Bible, Dante, Luther, Shakespeare, Byron, all are predominantly in French. This sounds like the library of any extremely well-read Russian gentleman circa 1830. The kind of reading that Pushkin gave to his standard-issue Russian romantic Eugene Onegin. But what is especially Pushkinian about the library? What does it tell us about his mind? I remember hearing about an accident that befell the scholar and critic Frank Kermode a few years ago. He was moving house and put all his most precious books, his fiction, his poetry, signed first editions and the like, in boxes on the street. The bin men came and mistakenly took the boxes, leaving Kermode with a great deal of contemporary literary theory. The story once seemed horrifying to me, and now seems almost wonderful. To be abruptly lightened like that, so that one's descendants might not be lingeringly burdened. After all, can I really contend that my own collection of almost unkillable, inert books, ranged on shelves like some bogus declaration of achievement, tells my children anything more about me than my much smaller collection of postcards and photographs? The more time I spent with my father-in-law's books, the more profoundly they seemed not to be revealing, but hiding him, like some word-wreathed, untranslatable mausoleum. The books somehow made him smaller, not larger, as if they were whispering, "What a little thing a single human life is, with all its busy, ephemeral, pointless projects." All ruins say this, yet we strangely persist in pretending that books are not ruins, not broken columns.
The Fun Stuff was read by Peter Firth, abridged by Eileen Horn, and produced by Clive Brill. It was a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Saturday the 8th of March. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Sole, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800... High, northeast France, 1,028. Expected Poland, 1,036 by 1800 Saturday. Low, mid-Atlantic, 960. Expected 100 miles south of Iceland, 950 by the same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira. Westerly 6 to gale 8, backing southerly 7 to severe gale 9 later, wintry showers, rain later, good occasionally poor. South Utsira